what is the number one reason that most people cannot get their Chapter 13 plan to balance when a second mortgage has been stripped? Now, there are several things. Number one, they could forget to remove the second mortgage payment from Schedule J because, as I say over and over again, everything on the plan is what the trustee pays. Everything on Schedule J is what the debtors pay. So if you have something inside the plan that the trustee is going to pay and you forget to take it off of Schedule J, then that's a double payment. So one of them has to be removed, and that is a big thing that happens quite frequently. So that's something to watch. Second of all, people forget to change the claim and the market value so that they match. Now, in your software, in all these software programs, regardless which one you're using, if you put in, say a person owes on a home $200,000, that's the claim amount. They owe that company $200,000 to get that paid for. But the market value, say, is only $150,000. If you put those two figures in and you have a claim amount of $200, market of $150, it's going to create $50,000 of unsecured amount because it's upside down, and that's what's happening. It used to not be that way, as you all know, but that's what's happening today. So that $50,000, most of these software programs take that $50,000 and they include it as an unsecured debt like you put on Schedule F, like with credit cards and everything else. And it's paid in the plan. Now, if you got a 10% plan, only 10% of it's going to be paid, but still it doesn't get rid of that $50,000. In order to get rid of the $50,000 so that the debtors don't pay it back at all would be to have the claim and the market value match. And that actually means going into the claim amount and actually keying in the new number. And you say, well, can I do that? Well, yeah, if you're going to document it, of course you can. So that's how that's done. Just always remember. However, as we know, every petition is different. So this may be okay for one situation and not for another. This is the way the court looks at it. If your debtor can afford to pay the whole thing, even if they take part of it and pay it unsecurely, then they need to pay it. But if they're so destitute that they can't pay that and you have to lower that payment, then they may be eligible for that strip down. Where people are making big mistakes is they're just assuming this is cookie cutter science, and it's not. You have to start out first with the maximum that that debtor can pay to those creditors. If they can't pay that, then you can start trying to help it and shave it down. If you don't do that, then there's going to be objections filed on these cases, and they're going to say, well, wait a minute, the debtors could afford to pay this. You all stripped it down, didn't have to. That's going to cause a lot of problems. So you just do pay the max you can, but still protect your debtor. Another thing that can happen when mortgages are being stripped is sometimes, again, it can be used in either situation. I just went over the Schedule F debt. You know, the strip count down can be taken to that drastic level. So I kind of covered number C before I got on. So I'll give you the example. That takes care of number one. Does anyone have any questions on that material? Okay, great. We'll move on to two. So what is the name of the motion that attorneys must use when stripping the second mortgage? Okay, there are different names for this. This, again, is not a cookie cutter thing. It is usually called a motion to avoid a secure lien, strip a second mortgage, whatever. Now, I've got this I put it together on the website. I went and spent a couple days doing research, and they name it different things, but it's a new motion, and I found it for my attorney, and I put it up there for you to purchase. I think it's like $18, but it's really good to have, because you can use that, go to your attorneys and say, hey, listen, I've got the motion to do this. The courts now are requesting a motion along with the petition being filed, and all that information is on that motion, and that's where I found it at. And it's a really basic motion. It outlines how much the people owe. Now, second mortgages are stripped because they're unsecure. If, say, for instance, you have a home for $300,000 and they owe $500,000 on the first mortgage, okay, they're already underwater, but they owe $200,000 on the second mortgage. Well, oops, $200,000, I'm sorry, you're not going to get paid, because if that house was liquidated, if that house was sold and auctioned off, they're only going to get $300,000 anyway. So that's not even going to pay the first mortgage. So those are debts that are eligible for strip downs on upside down mortgages. Does anybody have any questions on number two? Okay, you ready? You have anything? Okay. Now, number three, in the preparation of the bankruptcy petition, how are the unsecured portions of the liens provided for on the means test? Normally, if you're going to have an unsecured portion and you're going to strip it down, it's not going to be paid. So normally you would classify that as not in the plan, because it's not going to be repaid. If it's going to be repaid, of course, you're going to have to classify it as a secure pro rata, whatever, you know, the classification for that would be. Then on the means test, the amount that the debtors normally paid to this debt would not be listed, because they're not going to pay it anymore. So there's no need to factor in the monthly payment for this debt, since it's not going to be paid anymore. And that kind of satisfies number three. So am I making, like, such great sense that nobody has any questions?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You don't even have a question, Robin?
Yeah, I did have a question on the first one.
Yeah?
You said the house is matched.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you add the $50,000 back to the $150,000 for it to match?
No, you look at the appraised value, which would be the market value,
which was the $150,000.
And just go over to claim and make it match.
Okay.
Does that make sense? It's really very simple. And people, when I tell them that, they're like, claim. It's so simple. You just take... If their market value is $150,000, go over to claim and put $150,000.
Oh, okay. That makes sense, because I was trying. When I thought you meant you take the money, the $150,000, and then add it back to make it $200,000.
Don't worry about it, because look at that. When you do that, you have nothing left over to worry about.
Okay.
You see, it removes it because the numbers match.
Okay.
Okay.
I got it.
Got it. Great. Okay. Now moving on to number four. What are some quick tips for matching up Schedule I to the means test in order to reduce deficiency notices? I got a question called on this today. Somebody called and said, what is it that I can do? They're getting all mixed up on the means test. And I'm eventually going to make a new set of videos here, hopefully the next few months, and put all these little extra quickies on here. This is a super quick, easy tip for you.
Mm-hmm.
You start out by taking the total amount of income that's on Schedule I, and you enter that information into the income line of the means test. Now, if the debtors qualify for Chapter 7, you will only need to fill in that income. The purpose of the means test is to determine if somebody's going to file a 7 or a 13, period. So if you put an income in there and they qualify for a 7, oh, my God. I mean, your work is done, okay? If they don't, though, then you can start entering in some stuff. You can put in the taxes that's taken out, the child care. There's all kinds of different little things that you can put on there. Just read the means test and you'll see where they go. And then each time you enter this information in, sometimes it'll bring them back from a 13 to a 7. It's just going to depend on which one. You have to play with it a little bit sometimes. But you keep balancing that, and if you get everything entered and there's still a 13, then you have no choice. It has to be a 13. But in many cases, if you start out small and just keep building, and they sometimes comes a point they'll jump into a 7, and you're like, oh, my gosh. And right at that point, you can say to yourself, I just saved these debtors hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of dollars. And most people don't do that. Mm-hmm. And that's what can make you above the competition by doing these kinds of things. You are going to have it over attorneys. Believe me, I deal with attorneys on a daily basis. Deb does too.
Right.
And what we're telling you is true. These are things attorneys don't even know. So they've got their minds on so many other things. And if you build your skills and learn this stuff that's really easy, then you'll find out that your income will, you'll be more, non-disposable. So does anybody, everybody understand how to play with that means test and use it to your advantage? Okay, great. 5, what is the, go ahead, somebody start to say something. Okay. What is the suggested wording for item 17? I find this is such a really, you know, first grade level thing that I see it happen, though. Most people don't fill it in because they don't know what it means. On Schedule I, the question for item 17 says, describe any increase or decrease in income reasonably anticipated to occur within the year following the filing of this document. You know how legal stuff is. It reads on and on and on. The sentence never ends. But anyway, it's asking you, what does it say? Describe the increase or decrease in the income. If these people are on unemployment, they're getting ready to probably be off unemployment or get a job at some point within the next year, then you would put that down in that spot. If they were going to lose their job soon, you put that in that spot. Any increase or decrease, you put that in that spot. But if these people are on Social Security and pension and been like that for years, it's very doubtful their income is going to increase or decrease drastically within the next year. So then you basically just use the wording. No increase or decrease in the debtor's income is reasonably anticipated. I'm not asking you to write this down. What I'm saying is look at the question and just write it again. The question says describe any increase or decrease in income. No increase or decrease in the income is anticipated. Just follow what they say and just saying, you know, no, it's not going to happen. That makes it easy. Same thing for J. It asks you the same thing to describe increase or decrease. And, again, that's kind of first grade stuff, but just make sure you put it in. You wouldn't believe how many petitions I've seen kick back because that wording wasn't there and we had to do an amendment on it. Okay, number 6.
I have 2 minutes?
Yes, go ahead.
I think best case even, they even have a macro where you can copy the wording and you could fit it right in.
You are correct. Absolutely correct, Trenton. That is correct. And So for those who don't know, there's macro on there. And also, a lot of times, it'll come back and tell you that that wording wasn't put in. But there's also some softwares that won't do it. So, but some people bypass that stuff, you know. And I wrote an article one time about how to learn how to read. And it was based on that concept, you know, read your computer screen. Okay, number six, what are some quick tips regarding exemption selections and how not to commit unauthorized practice of law? One easy tip is to always do your exemptions last. Don't worry about Schedule C until you get that petition done. And the reason why is because as you're going along and doing different things, and then you'll do some research on the Internet, things can change. And you might find some additional assets that they didn't put on their intake form. So for the best thing to do is just go ahead and get the thing done, add in, you know, all the stuff you're supposed to, and then go back and do your exemptions at the end. And when you do, it makes a whole lot easier for you to figure out what goes with what. For instance, I had, and then the classification of them can also throw you off. So make sure you classify them right. I had an attorney this past week that he sent me, and he said, I can't get this thing to balance. And what it was he had put a tax refund on there that the debtor had received, but he put it under item 35. Which is personal property of any kind, whatever. It should have been under item 18, which says unliquidated debts owing debtor, including the tax refund. So whenever we did that, then the exemption totally exempted it and protected the debtor. When he put it under item 35, it didn't. And so that was the discrepancy in protecting that. And if we hadn't done that, I mean, $40,000 could have been lost, you know, by the debtor, things like that that you got to really watch out for.
Can we select it on the exemption, or do we let the software select it?
In the videos, I tell you to allow the software to select it. But what happened, Robin, after I said that, was that people were not selecting the correct debt classification and or the asset classification. They didn't select it. So say, for instance, they selected jewelry and it was wearing apparel, then the software program it's going to go by jewelry. It won't know the difference. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So people need to check their classification to make sure that it's correct before the exemption thing is going to work properly. So does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right. All right, now seven, how do you know if a motor vehicle is eligible for a cram down? Basically, it's two-year guideline right now. Things change, I guess, but the debt has to be older than 2 years old. Now, I questioned at first. I thought it was the car had to be, or the motor vehicle had to be 2 years old or older. No, the debt has to be. So if you were going to file bankruptcy tomorrow and you went out today and bought you a 1965 Ford Falcon, it's more than 2 years old, but the debt was just created within the last day, 90 days or so, or 2 years. So it would not be eligible for a cram down regardless what. So that's one thing is it does have, the debt itself has to be paid on by the debtors for a period of 2 years or more before it's eligible for a cram down. So watch for that when you have, usually these people have more than one car. I had a guy the other day, I had 18 or something. It was crazy. Okay, 18, so that's kind of like hard to figure out. So what I did was just whichever one had the most unexempt equity, then I applied the exemption to that one particular motor vehicle and then made a note about it. And then also, guys, don't forget about the 722 redemption, which is available to people. And in some instances, it does help, and some it doesn't. And we did a class on that before, and it's on the shopping cart, the 713training.com shopping cart, if you want to get that. So anyway, but on the bankruptcy petition for the cram down, again, how is it recorded? Well, we already talked about making sure that the claim and the market value match. And I always get this question, okay, I'm going to change the claim amount of what's owed. Isn't that going to cause a problem when it goes to court? You must remember that when it goes to court, this creditor will have to file a proof of claim. If they don't file proof of claim, it's no big deal. But, I mean, the debtor's won, but they're going to file proof of claim. When they do, if there's going to be a problem with that amount, they're going to object to it, and they're going to put on the proof of claim the corrected amount that they feel the debtor owes. Now, that's out of your hands. That is a chance that will be taken until Obama's law goes into effect, whatever he decides to do or what the mortgage thing happens. We are still in a transitional state, and this is the same sort of transition that we used to have from 2005, from like October to October 17th. So until we know what that new law is going to be, there's always a chance going to be taken when you propose cram downs. So don't think this is just going to like work 100% of the time. This is what we have to do at this point. So just keep as much up to date as you can on Obama's law and how that's going to change. So that's one of the things you do is you change the claim amount and the market value, and then you'll make sure that the monthly payment is removed from J, since they're going to be paying, usually cram downs are included in the plan and paid off over a period of time. So that usually is why you take the monthly payment off of Schedule J for their monthly expenditures. Any questions so far? Okay, is everybody asleep?
No.
Oh, good. Okay, all right. All right, number 8. What are some questionable expenses that attorneys need to be aware of before the petition's filed? And you need to know this as non-attorneys so that you can bring their attention to it. More and more, I am finding that there's so many new attorneys coming in out there on the market that they're, like, relying on us to do their job for them. So you guys being new at this, it's really difficult for you. That's why we created the petition review and those different things that you can just always use WISIS to help you out. So don't, you know, feel free to use that service. Because it only takes one or two, and you usually get the training you need. You can do the rest. But anyway, that is one of the things that that you know you have available to you. But questionable expenses such as on Schedule J, you have things like charitable contributions and food allowances for animals. This is a biggie, and I've had this conversation so many times, but I want to like cover it with you guys. You know, we love our animals, and sure, we want to allow food for them. But the court looks at it this way. They allow food if that animal is generating an income for the debtor. So if they're going out showing that dog and making money off of it, internet and shows, then, yeah, we can deduct some food expenses because it's kind of like a business. But you don't take it off for, you know, your little kitty cat and your pets, your animals, that like that. So what you need to do is just add it into the food allowance. If you've got $500 for food, then add in $525 or something, because you just, those are questionable expenses. Now, in the old days, before the law changed, we didn't have to much worry about this stuff. That's why you might run into some of the old school people that says, hey, man, we don't have to worry about that stuff. Today, it's a different world. The credit card companies are looking, they're like little roaches looking for everything that they possibly can to get these debtors on. So working on the debtor side, we have to try to protect them. So things like charitable contributions can be questioned. Things like the food, the money paid to somebody living outside the home. Try to look for things that these people don't have to survive. Sure, it's great to pay mom's rent because mom's rent dropped, but, you know, these credit card companies probably won't care. So things like that, and you take those expenses and you absorb them into the allowable expenses, you're saying, oh, my gosh, that's fraud. No, you document what you're doing so that the attorney can explain to the client what's going on. Don't ever hide anything that you're doing and think, you know, you're trying to protect somebody. In law, everything is documented, black, white, that's it. I mean, it's right there. And nobody, so you know, just make sure you document this stuff. They had, I usually put stuff like this down. They had a food allowance for their dog for $10, and I added it to their food expense for the family. You know, that way that stuff is taken care of. Now, I'm not talking about hundreds of dollars. I'm talking about a few bucks, and this is the kinds of things that you need to do. Kids in college, you know, that kind of stuff. So this is important because, and then what happens, though, if the attorney does not tell the creditor, tell the debtor, I've seen it in court, and I know you probably have too, Deb. You go in, and they get into court, and the trustee says, are these your expenses on Schedule J? Oh, no. They forgot to put my dog's expense down there for his flea shots.
Right.
And, boom, guess what happens? The petition's pulled. Time's lost. You have to get receipts. It can cost the client literally thousands of dollars and more time, unless the attorney does it free. All they need to do is keep their mouth shut. And I usually see attorneys walking around before all 341's meetings, just say yes or no, just say yes or no, just say yes or no.
Right, you're right.
Because these people will open their mouth and start screaming.
Yeah. How would you list them? I'm in, like, Southeast Iowa. And all of the debtors here, their kids are really into sports, and the parents pay a lot of money, you know, for uniforms and travel. And.
Well, do they allow those things in that particular jurisdiction?
They really don't. I mean, I've looked at it, and I haven't gotten any objections yet, but it's going to happen.
Because you can look at some of the ones that's already been filed and went through to see if they had objections to them. You know, what kind of money are you talking about?
You know, I told him to kind of average out, and, you know, I have one right now where his kids play basketball, football, and he plays all the sports. And so, you know, probably like $100-$150
a month if you're trying to absorb it under, like, personal expenses or, Deb, help me here. Do you know another
one?
Miscellaneous that the IRS allows for so much for miscellaneous expense.
Yeah, okay.
So you might want
to compare
that. That should help, Brenna. Can you think of anything else, Deb?
No, I'm actually just, you know, going over in my head here what else is on that, but you're right. It's miscellaneous and the personal. I would put it under personal. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and hopefully now they might not question that kind of expense, but if it gets into the, you know, usually $600 or more is kind of like the magic thing number. It's not like it's all written in stone, but, usually 600 or more, they start kind of looking close.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you get into that kind of level for sports, yeah, it could have a question on it. So, okay. Let's see. What is our next one? We're up to number 9. Okay. Although attorneys make the ultimate decision, what are some things that non-attorneys need to be aware of to assist their attorneys in making the best whatever? The best thing you can do for your attorney is document everything. I start out with, I open up my WordPerfect document, whatever you're using, my blank document, and I just start listing stuff as I go through it. As I'm going through those debts and things or those client intake forms, if there's missing information or if I'm doing it and I think of something, like, well, wait a minute, if they live in a condo, they have to have homeowner's fees. So, okay, do I see homeowner's fees? No. Okay, let me make a note of that. They need to pay homeowner's fees. Then I go back, well, maybe later on in this stuff, when I get over there, I'll find out what the homeowner's fees are, and I can take them out. So these are just kind of like helpful things, but it, just document everything when you are doing that petition. You know, I know my videos that don't do anything on Schedule C and all of this kind of stuff, but we have worked more with the attorneys and basically found out they take an oath, an ethical oath, that they are responsible for all the work of anybody they hire. So you're working for them. You're not working for the debtor, and they have responsibility for that. However, if you don't document what you're doing and give them the ability to know what's happening, you could get in trouble. They might come into that and say, well, wait a minute. You didn't tell the attorney the truth, you know. So as long as you document what you're doing, you're okay. Deb, do you have something to add to that? Because you worked in this quite a bit.
You know what? And that's what I do. I mean, I document everything, absolutely everything. And that way when the attorney actually is looking at the file and they have a question about something, and I usually do like a little memo to the file so that I actually have everything on there. Like you were saying about your Word document, everything
right.
on there. That's exactly what I do.
Right. And then I save that. I electronically, I have files on my computer. Say I've got Joe Attorney. Inside of Joe Attorney's folder, there's a folder for every single client that I've ever done for Joe Attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
inside that client folder, I have got every single piece of information. If I have an email from a client or anything dealing with that case, mm-hmm. I save it as a PDF.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason you do need to make sure that you have some kind of a, you might have to buy Adobe, I don't know, but it's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
But I save that email as a PDF and save it right to that client file. That way I have documentation of everything. You want a paper trail. That's going to protect you totally.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Victoria?
Yeah.
When you say document everything, do you document each line that you do, or you just document certain sections?
Well, no, hon. They can look at the petition and tell.
Okay.
We're talking about document your what's going on with the case. Now, give an example.
Here is an example, actually, that I just was doing this week. This was in a Chapter 7, not a 13, but still I had to document this. The trustee actually had changed a petition, a bankruptcy from a no asset to an asset, which I don't know if everybody knows what that is, but in any event, we had to file an objection. And in doing so, when we filed the objection, we had to amend the schedules because what Victoria was talking about earlier was the market value and the claim. There was a second mortgage that was on this house that we didn't know about initially, and it threw everything off. So the trustee assumed then that they had more equity in the house than they actually did. And so what we did was I documented why I changed my Schedule A to reflect a different dollar amount than what initially had been filed. And I just wrote down in my Word document, you know, that this is what happened and why it was changed. And then that way I have it and the attorney has it. And so that if he questions it once he gets to, you know, the next meeting, because it was actually scheduled then for a hearing, he's going to know exactly what happened now because it's not scheduled until December.
Right.
That's what we do.
So you document things that can matter about the case. I mean, they can look and see that you entered $2.14 on line 67.
Okay.
You know, no, I mean, that's not the kind of documentation we're talking about. Does that make more sense now?
Okay.
Hey, Victoria, right. Can we just go back 1 second to
what
Cindy had asked about the uniforms and stuff for the kids? You know, for the other exemptions.
Yeah.
I was looking at my at a Schedule J, you know, for the expenses. And actually, some that we have done where we actually put on for the uniforms for the kids, I've seen some now that we've put it on line number 17, which just says other, and then we list what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Or we've also put it up under number 5, which is the clothing line, and just added in with the clothing.
Well, you know, I've never saw, I've saw objections filed where it says other, because then they want to know what other means, and they want the documentation, like all the receipts and all that kind of thing. Now, what is under clothing?
It just says clothing.
I'll tell you guys, it's one trick I use that works many times. Say, for instance, you've got those uniforms or whatever.
Right.
The sports stuff.
Right.
Let's say $150. If you look at the IRS allowances and you see what the debtor puts down, often you can raise those to where it more than compensates for getting rid of that $150 for uniforms.
Absolutely.
For example, I had debtors put down that they've only, you could, like, say they had a food allowance at the IRS the other day, I think it was like $900 because they had like 4 people. So they had $900 food allowance for the IRS, and they had put down $450, for instance. Well, I could raise that to $800 and still be within the IRS allowance, and that would more than compensate for taking off. You see where I'm coming from?
Mm-hmm. That's
so
right.
That's another little trick you can do.
Yes.
You know, that's another little thing there. So that's pretty cool. Let's see. Yeah, I wrote it down, Deb. We had it on here.
Yeah.
Now, when that means test, before I forget, I've had some courts reject them because that DMI, which means disposable monthly income, it doesn't match Schedule J. So one thing, always remember to try to match that as close as possible. That's why I told you, take your amount that's on Schedule I for the income and just lump it on Schedule J, the means test, I'm sorry, and if they qualify for 7, you're okay, but you've got the correct number in there for the DMI. And what happens is a lot of people get hung up on entering all of those paycheck stubs. And where the court has found this problem, they should have saw it before, but they say, and it's true, if somebody was earning a lot of money 6 months ago and now they're earning nothing, there is no way that Schedule I and J is going to balance with the DMI on the means test. There's no way, because they made a whole bunch more money than they do now.
Mm-hmm.
Or vice versa. So this is an argument that is still ongoing. You know, I keep track of all that. I get all these emails and all this stuff, and I keep track of this, and it's ongoing right now as to which is the best way to handle it. So, you know, but at this point, we have to closely make it as close as possible. So just pay attention to it and make any kind of adjustments. I don't have an example to kind of show you, but because it depends on the petition. But just so you understand, that DMI has been questioned in the past. Okay, we got number 10. Deb, how are we doing on time?
Actually, it's 9:19.
Well, let me think. That's 7:19. Okay,
I'm sorry.
Oh, good. Well, this is coming out to be about right. Okay, why is it important to document the benefits to the debtor for the 13 plan? I started doing this, I don't know, a few weeks ago, and I want you to know these attorneys love it. They just really like it, and this will impress them. On the Chapter 13 plan, when you get them done, then you've got a summary of all the different things that went on with that and how much money is being saved. Now, we're teaching the attorneys now at their level to make sure in order to sell these plans. See, the problem originated from there's about 80% of the people filing a Chapter 13 plan do not complete it. It gets dismissed because of non-payment. Now, the reason it gets dismissed for non-payment is because the debtors do not feel that they need to stay in it. What's the benefit of it? So they save their money and just don't pay anymore. That is the majority of reasons. Of course, there's other reasons as to where they have no money to pay it. But the majority of time, it's because they just kind of lose interest in the payment and it just kind of goes downhill. They get their problem solved and whatever. So in order to combat this problem and to make money for everybody and keep the debtors into the plan longer and get their debts dismissed, we are taking that the information and putting it onto this cover sheet form. And I'll put down my summary of Chapter 13 plan. And here's a few examples that I use. The student loan, we had one the other day and I wrote this down. The student loan owed to Wachovia Bank in the amount of $1,549 is proposed to be paid at 26%. That's how much the debt turned out to be. So this means that the debtors only have to pay back $402 on this particular student loan. Wachovia Bank, this was not, we now are putting the student loans on Schedule F, and that's because so many of them are not government-backed anymore. They, if they're government-backed, they still have to be paid back 100%. But so many of these online schools and classes and extracurriculum, people just pay for them, and this is, or go to Wachovia Bank and get a loan. But that's what this was. So it became an unsecured debt, even though it was an educational loan. And they only had to pay back $402 of it. So that right there saved the debtors $1,146. Mm-hmm. Then the next thing, the payment for the VW. We had a Volkswagen that was reduced from $350 a month down to $30 a month. And why did that occur? It was because we did the cram down, and it made the car at a different value. Say they paid back $1,500. Well, $1,500 over a period of 5 years came to be like $30. So that really saved the debtor right there, $320 a month. So you see what I'm doing? I'm picking out the advantages for the debtor and giving them to the attorney so that the attorney can turn around and sell this plan, and it will keep the debtors in it at a longer time. Now, when you start doing these skills, another thing this is going to do for you, it's a double helper for you, is it will teach you marketing skills. Marketing skills are picking out advantages to your customer and letting them know about it. So that is another skill that this will build, but this is what you use it for. Another example, $130,000 for the first mortgage is paid as unsecured. This means the debtors only have to pay back $33,000 as it's unsecured. That saves them $96,200. And then, so things like this that you can put down for them, and this information is right there in front of your eye. it's on that calculator plan that Case has, which I think is one of the best little tools out there. And that plan will show you exactly what's going on, and you can summarize it for the attorney. And I even put a little note. Let's see, what was it? I wrote it down here. I put this little note for the attorneys and said, the following information can be used to help sell the benefits of the Chapter 13 plan. Presenting a good Chapter 13 plan the debtors are happy with will aid in keeping them in the plan for a longer period of time. So I told them why I was providing it, and you just wouldn't believe things like this that you do for attorneys that nobody else does. Nobody takes the extra time to do this stuff is going to make you invaluable, and it's going to keep you in work for a long period of time. Do you agree with me, Deb?
Absolutely.
You've got to take these little extra steps, and there's your inside key stuff.
And you know what? The attorneys really do appreciate that when you point all this stuff out to them.
Sure. Even if they aren't going to change it, or if they do change it, it doesn't matter. They still know that you care about the case and you're trying to do a good job.
Absolutely.
And when you make friends with attorneys, you don't have to worry, because they will bend over backwards to help you, don't they, Deb?
Yes, they do. Absolutely.
They sure do. Deb and I both have attorneys that call us once in a while and say, I just want to discuss a case with you and get your input on how I'm going to present it at court. Well, you know, if you've been a paralegal like we have for 30 years, you can do that kind of stuff. And they love it, don't they, Deb?
They sure do.
You know, they do love to do that. So, but that in turn, you know, I mean, don't think that we're wonderful people, but in turn, I can turn around and use that information and train you guys, which is, Deb's going to help with training too. So be glad we can do that, because then we can pass that all on to you. So open up for questions, comments, anything.
Victoria,
yes.
Robin,
on
the crown downs, do we do that on our own, or do the attorney suggest that and we do it? Who initiate the crown down?
Well, crown downs are you're talking about in cars or homes?
In homes.
Okay. Well, like I said, we don't know at this point, you know, how it's really going to plan out. The first thing you do is go ahead and enter the debt in the way it's supposed to be entered, and find out if the debtors can meet that payment and pay it. If they can't, then you can start on a cram down. And it's going to depend on if they've got a first or second mortgage. It depends on the amount you're dealing with. You know, there's no, like I said, no cookie cutter thing here.
Okay.
So you're just going to have to either give me a specific example, or when you get to it, you're going to have to call us and we'll help you.
Oh, okay.
Because that's one of those questions that can't be answered on a general term.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you answer that question then?
No.
Not in a general term, no.
No. And you know what? And it's true. I mean, it's a case-by-case It's case by case. You know what I mean?
Because things work to the advantage of different people.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know? If you bought Deb a gold ring, she'd just be thrilled to death, wouldn't you, Deb?
Absolutely.
But if you bought me one, I'd take it away from me because I'm allergic to gold. So there's two different reactions to the same thing, and that's how it is with a bankruptcy.
Oh, okay. That's a different perspective. I never looked at it like that before.
Yeah.
That's a totally different perspective. I thought, because with the sevens, it seemed like it's a cookie cutter thing. Once you learn it, you learn it. But
not really, Robin. Not really. When you get to doing them, you're going to find out they really are very unique.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
I mean, everybody, yes, normally has household goods, and almost everybody has a car and stuff. But there's people that don't have cars. There's people that's got 27 cars.
Right.
There's just so many variances to so many things. So it's, you know, that's why it's kind of fun. I like bankruptcy because each one is so different.
Me too.
So.
But that's very true, because when you first hear about, when I first heard about it, I thought it was like, oh, this will be simple. You just do the little foreign thing and that's it. But now that I'm more into it, it's like you said, it take on a different personality than when I first thought. That's where the learning process come in.
Right.
That you know, oh, it's not exactly this simple. It's detailed.
No, it's not data entry. That's one of the first things we tell people. It's not data entry.
Mm-hmm.
If it were, everybody could do it, and
mm-hmm.
there wouldn't be any sense of hiring professionals to do it.
Mm-hmm.
What we have is very unique. Deb, you want to back me up on that one?
Absolutely. You know, I was thinking about making this comment to Robin, Ashley. You know, when you do a Chapter 7 and you start doing them for, you know, whoever, and each one is a unique situation, you get to know those people so well as far as what's going on with them that, you know, what may be a real simple, like I had one bankruptcy Chapter 7 that was just all the lady had was no assets. She didn't own anything, but she had like $40,000 in credit card debt.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. And then, you know, then the next one that I did, I mean, this guy had six cars. He had over $100,000 in credit card debt. I mean, it varies so much, but each one is unique. And you get to kind of look at, you know, how these people got to that point and then understand why they're at that point.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you find out that your problems aren't so bad.
That's true.
You do. Your own life takes on a great new meaning. Hey, I'm not so bad. Clay said, I thought I was a bad money manager, but I just found out that I'm the equivalent to a CPA. And it only took him two petitions and he made that announcement.
Oh, my goodness.
Exactly. I have a question, Virginia, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Going back to number 10, I think I heard you mention that there was something on Best Case about doing the summary of the savings that of the benefits.
Yeah, it's right. When you use the calculator, the Chapter 13 plan calculator,
yeah.
You'll see it come up with all of your information.
Oh, but you have to be in Chapter 13, all right?
I have to be in Chapter 13. Deb, do you know what you're talking about?
Yeah, you would have to be in Chapter 13 to get the calculator up.
Okay.
Yeah, oh, okay. Go to Voluntary Petition, Trenton, and change them into a 13 so that you can see all the additional stuff.
Right.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I didn't understand your question at first. I apologize. Okay, anything else anybody has?